project. What I just want to underline very clearly is that the environmental assessment for the A to Z, they call it an experiment, avoids discussing the elephant in the room. In a precedent-setting move, the Forest Service granted the company Vagen Brothers, it's a for-profit timber corporation, has been given broad and sweeping powers that include designing the A to Z project in the first place, doing the environmental analysis, writing, this is a private for-profit timber corporation, gets to write the environmental assessment, deciding where, how, and how much to log, where and how many roads need to be constructed, and just about everything else associated with a timber sale. That's it. On that note, this has been Air Cascadia Thought Monday, April 6, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand, and be sure to send in comments.
At the Erez crossing, which is where you enter Gaza from. So apparently, when you go into Gaza, you have to walk until you get to the first town there. And apparently that walk is very dangerous.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Thursday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 338. Guest speaker will be Stephen Saleta, former Virginia Tech professor. That's Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom, sponsored by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, on Thursday, April 9th, 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University, Smith Center, room 338. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
And by Volunteers of America, Oregon, presenting a symposium on diversity, equity, and economic stability, May 8 at the Child Center. Keynote speaker Stedman Graham. Tickets and information at volunteersofamericaoregon.org. Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. Host Barbara Bernstein is on break this month. So on today's program, we'll hear a roundtable discussion on the future of food in Oregon from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference held at the University of Oregon Law School in early March. The title of the panel is Winning Grassroots Campaigns on a Shoestring Budget, Jackson and Josephine Counties. The first speaker is farmer Chris Hardy of Our Family Farms Coalition, Village Farm. So please stay tuned.
So I'm Chris Hardy. I'm a farmer in Southern Oregon. Back in 2012, I looked to lease a piece of land right in the, virtually in the city limits of Ashland, Oregon, Southern Oregon, Jackson County, and I spoke to a landowner, and we walked around his property, and he was showing me this other piece of his land, and I asked him what was going on there, and he said, well, I'm leasing the other half of my land to the Swiss company to produce genetically engineered sugar beets. And as he was saying that, what was running through my mind was that we were just right down the road producing the same family that would be contaminated from the seeds that were produced from those sugar beets. We were producing Swiss chard. It's from the same family. We'd saved seeds on our Swiss chard for a number of years. Off on the other side of my shoulder as I looked, there were three grade schools right there. And this Swiss company told me they were using 23 different chemicals to produce this technology in our county and in the Rogue Valley in Southern Oregon in Josephine and Jackson County. So that was kind of the wake-up call back in 2012. And in 2013, we lost our seed contract because the same chemical company said they would be putting sugar beets in the ground less than a quarter of a mile away from where we were producing chard and beets for our Swiss chard for seed contract. And our buyer basically said, unless there's any way that we can test the seed and certify that the test is GMO free, they would not be able to buy those seeds from us. And so that kind of left us in a really challenging, difficult position to spend the next 4 or 5 months producing a seed crop that may have zero worth to it. As any degree of contamination in that seed crop, as we were told, would basically void that contract. In 2014, two counties in Southern Oregon, Josephine and Jackson County, unanimously voted to support banning and removing genetically engineered crops to protect family farming and the way of life for so many farms across Rogue Valley in Southern Oregon. Yes. And I should add, Jackson County had 66% of the vote support. Two out of one voters said, get this stuff out of here. And so it was very clear. It was very clear in Josephine, 58%. Again, solidly behind. You know, it wasn't like it was some fringe movement like the chemical companies that spent so much money to put in the campaign tried to paint this movement and this effort as a fringe deal. Humboldt County and three other counties here in 2014, just a few months ago, either passed a moratorium on the growing of genetically engineered crops. Humboldt outright followed Jackson and Josephine County's lead, banning them. And as we know now, there are a number of lawsuits in the case of Hawaii and in the case of Jackson County that are trying to overturn our work and our work in democracy, essentially. And so, in order to protect our farmers and to protect our seeds, this is the actions that are necessary. Coexistence, as we know in the case of Jackson and Josephine County, are not possible. We are being told that coexistence should be possible there, as it should be possible here in the Willamette Valley, as it should be possible across the United States. Understand that in the case of sugar beets and Swiss chard and table beets, 80% of all those seeds that go into garden seed packets or farmer's seeds of any farmer, if anybody here eats local food or goes to the grower's market or runs down to the garden store to pick up a seed packet, there's an 80% chance those seeds were produced in Southern Oregon or here in the Willamette Valley. So once we start getting that through our heads that GM sugar beets are being produced throughout the Willamette Valley and have to this point and continue to be, at least in Josephine County, we have confirmed reports that they are being planted as we speak. This puts in direct threat the food supply of this nation. 50% of the world's chard and beets and sugar beets come from these same regions. So understand that just 5 years on here, we have seen an increase from what was 50% genetically engineered seeds to what is now 97% genetically engineered seeds for sugar beets. So even if I was a farmer of sugar beets and didn't want to grow GM seed, patented seed, and sign a contract with Monsanto, I would not really have much of a choice. You know, you have only to pick up the phone and call around to a few seed companies and see if they test their sugar beet seeds, if you can even find sugar beet seeds, or just look on the USDA's website and you will see that 97% of all those are genetically engineered. So this is it's really important that we show up to protect our farmers, because our farmers who grow our food need to have the choices to grow the way they want to, and in its current form, as the USDA has handed down, the coexistence plan is clearly failing our food system. And so it's really important that we show up in ways that we can to protect and preserve the seeds that are traditionally produced and non-genetically engineered. And stay tuned on the lawsuit in Jackson County. More to come. Thanks.
So my name is Brent Foster. I'm an environmental attorney. I worked with a number of the Willamette Valley farmers fighting the attempt to plant GMO canola in the Willamette Valley a couple of years ago. We were successful in overturning an Oregon Department of Agriculture attempt to let that through, along with Scott Jerger and George Kimbrell, Center for Food Safety. And myself, along with Leah and other Earthrise Law Center and Center for Food Safety, are involved in defending the Jackson County ban on GMOs. What I wanted to do first is just play, because it was interesting for me. Look, this was a David and Goliath battle in both Jackson and Josephine County. And the fact that we won, and the fact that this is really one of these rare victories where Monsanto could come in, Dow, DuPont and company dropped $500,000 into Jackson County in one day. It is probably the largest expenditure in a county race, certainly ever in Jackson County, probably in every county, possibly even the big counties. It was, to give you some scale of how much money was spent against it, in the Measure 92 race, which was the most expensive race in Oregon history, $20 million was spent by the chemical companies trying to stop labeling GMOs. That came out to something about $13.60 or so per voter. That's how much they spent. In Jackson County, the price was almost $16.50 per voter. So they spent more per voter. But there's this other little wrinkle that in Jackson County, you can buy a television commercial in prime time for $50. Right? So that same amount of money, which was more per voter than went into 92 in Jackson County, was so intense that you couldn't turn on the TV for a minute without just seeing the barrage of ads. And we had to sit there one night and watch TV, and you would see the ads and it would make you cringe. But I want to give you a sense of it. We pulled a couple ads from the opposition and then a couple ads on behalf of the farmers, and it just gives you an idea about the messaging that both sides were using and how this was framed up.
In the Rogue Valley for 5 generations. When I first started working out on the farm, I was 2. My dad is one of the hardest working people that I know. He has put his whole entire life into this farm, and it'd mean everything if it went down. Measure 15-119 would limit my future. It would hurt family farms like mine. I grow things here. I want to stay here. But if this passes, it'll destroy my family. It would be very hard for me to be able to leave this valley.
That we've dubbed the Crying Farmer Act. I well up every time I see it. The one ad from Josephine County that I wish we had that we don't actually had a guy, I forget if he was in a black mask, but it was like a burglar stalking outside the house. And the implication is if you voted to ban GMOs, you would be like supporting. I just thought when that kind of gives you a sense of what was going on. And the two lessons, in thinking about how banning GMOs could work around the country and other places, the two things I think are really important. And first is obviously talking about the impact on farmers. You can talk to a lot of people who say, I'm not worried about the health effects of GMOs. In fact, I don't care about them. I don't believe it. There's scientific dispute, et cetera. But I agree with you. I've heard about that they can obviously cross-pollinate. They can commingle. I don't know if you've been reading the news, but like U.S. non-organic farm corn growers over the last year and a half have lost over $2 billion with a B dollars because China blocked U.S. corn exports to China after Syngenta's genetically engineered corn was found in some of the corn stock. They're starting to do something similar with genetically engineered alfalfa. The range of economic impacts that there have been from GMO contaminations is huge. And I think one of the biggest problems with messaging GMOs is that there are so many impacts is how do we focus on some of the most important. And to me, being able to message, and Chris did an incredible job, and a lot of the other farmers, Elise Higley, who's the director of Family Farmers Coalition, done an incredible job of messaging that. So that's one thing I think, just if you're looking at a ban and you want to try to win off health effects, good luck. I don't think you're going to do it. But this was really an effort started by farmers. It had farmers at the core, and the effect is to benefit farmers. The other big thing that, if you heard, when we're describing GMOs, most people, and we saw this during the GMO labeling campaign, they believe that genetically engineered crops are engineered for drought resistance, higher yields, all sorts of things. When in fact, virtually every genetically engineered crop on the market today is engineered for just one thing, which is to be able to withstand getting sprayed by large amounts of herbicides, or to produce its own herbicides, or produce its own pesticides, right? It's all herbicide centric. And that when I saw one of the women from Consumer Reports go on, I think it was ABC News morning talk show, after they found GMOs and all these common products, she did not mention the word pesticides or herbicides in explaining why people should be concerned about GMOs. So being able to message and inform people that GMOs are basically high pesticide, high herbicide foods, to me, it was part of the campaign. It was part of the messaging. It wasn't the centerpiece, but it's a piece that makes for a really persuasive talk. So I will leave it at that, and maybe send it over to some of the Josephine County folks if we want to bounce back, or you want to just keep going.
Okay. So I'm Barbara Richard. I'm from Jackson County. I was deeply involved in the campaign, not from the beginning, but for a long time. And one of the reasons that we were successful is there was a lot of hard work that was done by a lot of people. We ran a high visibility campaign. What that meant was we were constantly tabling, we were constantly out in the community, we were selling things, we were educating people. Anytime we had an opportunity to do a presentation in front of a small group, we took that opportunity. What we found was if you had the opportunity to have a conversation with someone, more often than not, they'd get it. Our most effective tool was a map that had 4-mile concentric circles drawn on it, and the circles were around known GMO sugar beet plots.
Suspected, because they were secret. They wouldn't tell us where they were, so we had to guess.
And 4 miles, at the time that it was regulated, that was the separation distance. And if you look at the Rogue Valley, it is not a wide valley. It's very narrow. You start placing these 8-mile diameter circles around the valley, you've used up all the land. And so people saw that and immediately understood that there just was no way to coexist. Pollen knows no borders. And, you know, it's pollen time, the wind comes along, and it finds something it likes, you know, it's going to go there. So we were out in the community a lot. Jackson County is a very conservative county. To talk a bit more about messaging, we found that it was really important. We did some polling to find out really what was going to be effective. There were a lot of people a lot of our supporters came to the campaign motivated by some aspect of the GMO issue, but we couldn't really go with all of those different aspects for several reasons. One is we needed to focus. Two is we couldn't just talk to the choir because we needed more votes than the choir was gonna cough up. And so we did our best to speak to the conservative end of the county, knowing that our base was going to be with us anyway. And that perhaps was the most challenging part of the campaign, was staying on message. And because a lot of our supporters are very, very passionate about this. And this issue started by a farmer, it was about farmers, and in the end, it's about farmers, our food supply, and that's where we needed to focus. And to get distracted by any of the other issues was not going to be beneficial. Our spokespeople, Chris did a great job, continues to do so. Elise, who unfortunately was not able to be here, she always made herself available. She is a farmer. She is very articulate on the subject. We also had a fairly coordinated letter to the editor writing campaign. It built upon itself, and in the process, we ended up building community. We had a huge list. We still have a huge list, and in fact, we've actually had some businesses come forward just recently saying, I want to be on your supporter list. So we had a list of how many farms?
We had 180 farms from my last count, and that continues
and,
to grow.
And the businesses, I don't know, 500 businesses, which for our small region was really substantial. So I think at some point neighbors looked around and, you know, they saw who is supporting this and thought, well, you know, maybe this is something I need to look into. And you know, why is everyone supporting it? Brent already talked about contamination, and the truth there is that if the farmer's crop gets contaminated, not only would they have something that they, it's not what they intended to sell, but it would be illegal because it's a patented product. Basically, we stuck to a very positive message, as you saw, not the scare tactics. And we also made it fun. Some of you may have heard about our tractor brigade, which was about a little less than 3 weeks before Election Day. We had a press event in Medford, and we had, I believe it was 18 tractors, one for each day left before the election, come tractoring down the main drag in Medford in midday. It was quite a spectacle. Well, and after, yes, we were in front of the Woolworth Building, which was where our campaign headquarters was.
And we ended up at Walmart.
yeah, with a police escort.
Super Walmart, brand newly installed Super Walmart.
Anyway, the two biggest lessons that I took from the activity was the power of community, keep it local. Oftentimes in campaigns, there is a desire to go out and get the big money or big endorsements or whatever. That was the problem that the No campaign had. They had the big money. When we would get a check in the mail, sometimes it was a $5 check from a substitute teacher. And I would look at that, and I knew it was more than a $5 check. It was a $5 check and a vote. And keep it local, make it about community, and you've got a great chance of winning.
I just want to add two last things before we pass to the other side, too. One of the things that I think was, there are so many people involved, a couple of them like Leno, who's sitting there in the sweet hat, did an incredible job of outreaching to the Latino community in Jackson County. And Mark and others, there were so many layers with people going into and doing outreach to non-traditional. We had Republicans that when the chemical companies came in and tried to get the Jackson County Republican Party to oppose the measure, they had a packed room full of Republican activists there saying, no way, and they blocked them. So not even the Republican Party of Jackson County opposed this thing, even though the statewide Republican Party did. And so I thought that was just to add another really critical thing. You think you can win based on convincing liberals or people who are with you, don't you know that's not really. I mean, maybe in Humboldt you can do that, but not in Jackson County, and frankly, not in most places. And I think.
Can you speak a little more to that strategy? How do you develop those unconventional allies? Like, so we're talking about the Republicans that are fourth generation farmers that normally wouldn't want to speak up. I work in Montana, really rural places, and we have a lot of GMO crops, and I keep on trying to always think, how do we reach out to these unconventional allies? They shut their doors. They weren't old 25s.
I think it's a great question. I think, why don't we let these guys talk, and then we'll do Q&A at the end, if that's okay, just because
I'll write your question down, though.
Yeah, Mary's going to really speak to that, because that was the key to our success in Josephine County. Did you want to see?
Do you guys want to start with the video?
Okay. We'll just start with one of our campaign videos that really worked well. In Josephine County, Medford passed with 58% of the votes, and I was just saying that Josephine County is known as one of the most conservative counties in the state, And the measure passed with 58% of the vote.
Locus Focus host Barbara Bernstein is on break this month, so we have been listening to a roundtable discussion on the future of food in Oregon from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference held at the University of Oregon Law School in early March. The title of the panel is Winning Grassroots Campaigns on a Shoestring Budget, Jackson and Josephine Counties. We're going to hear part two of that talk right now. Well, I think we are.
One of our campaign slogans was stand up. We wanted everybody in the community to stand up. So we had these little commercials, 15 seconds long, that's all we could really afford. And we were paying for airtime, you know, as we got money in, just to put more and more on there. But we had various local people in the community say what they're standing up for by voting for this measure.
They're not playing.
Okay. So, stand up was one of our slogans. And just to speak a little bit about the group that came together in Josephine County, there was a steering committee of...
shout out to Carol and Mel.
Carol and Mel, both members of the steering committee that were, kind of planning the strategies and planning things out. But we had a real, true grassroots effort. Josephine County, in terms of populace, is slightly smaller than Jackson County, and we ran a successful campaign with just over $20,000. So we had contributions as little as $1, and Mel DeLeva right there logged every single one of those. So when the core group came together, one of the things that was very important was that it was a mix of conservatives and liberals. So Jackson County being the neighboring county, the GMO issue had hit the news because the media buy, so to speak, of the area is the same area. There's certainly local radio stations for just Josephine County, but the TV stations covered both counties. So the Good Neighbor Farmers, the PAC on the other side with millions of dollars of opposition money, was able to, you know, just cover both counties with their media buys of voting no on their measure and voting no on ours.
And I was going to add, Dan Bowden, who was going to speak on this panel, I wish he had been able to make it, but unfortunately he was not. He is an evangelical Christian, Republican, right-wing, very articulate, very passionate about this issue. He went out, he got us entree into churches and Republican groups. And we had other members on our steering committee. Carol was very instrumental in the Illinois Valley. And we had this perfect mixture of people who could pretty much speak to every audience. And once we talked about farmers and economic rights of our farmers, and we agree, we didn't really touch on the health concerns other than the pesticide issues. We were able to talk to everybody, and that's what we would recommend doing.
And with the limited budget that we had, one of the more successful things that we were able to utilize was a letter to the editor campaign. And in our small local paper in Grants Pass, Oregon, there were at least 10 letters a week for the last six weeks of the campaign. And we're talking about a newspaper that only prints four to six letters a day. And so to have one or two of those every day of the week, five days a week is when it's published, to have one of those to be in support of Measure 1758, we simply made up a document with the instructions of how to submit a letter. We never instructed people what to say. We just asked that they end their letter with vote yes on 1758. And the concerned citizens and ordinary people who stood up with us against corporate control of our food supply, and for family farmers. The local farmers were with us in our small community. We had well over 50 farms and well over 250 businesses that signed on in support, and we were calling the radio stations. I've got another $100. Can you put me on the schedule for, throwing things in at the last minute. Some of the more creative things that we also did was we had a flash mob at the growers market. That was really fun. There was a First Friday art event that's fairly common in small towns throughout Oregon. And we did a huge chalk art event where we had artists that volunteered their time to do a yes on 1758 with our slogan on the side of a wall, quite big. And then we wrote stand up, and people came and were able to write what they were standing up. They were standing up for their local farmer. They were standing up for their children and the livelihood of their families and for their children's children.
And we had some amazing volunteer videographers and media artists, Antonio and Tina. And I can't remember that other. Anyway.
Yeah.
They volunteered so much time and skill videotaping our commercials and the chalk art, editing into these commercials to comply with the TV requirements. Our volunteers were incredible.
Another interesting thing was like Food Integrity Project was kind of a spin-off. Mm-hmm. And so it was community driven, and it was basically, let's approach restaurants, let's just start the dialogue. Let's see, will they switch one item menu where you can just order something GMO free? And it was like a leaf rating system based on how much percentage of your menu went from 0% GMO free to 100%. And that still has an impact in the community. And it's
absolutely
still, there was a still restaurant going. Week like kind of event where go out and support GMO free dining,
And the restaurants that participate in the Food Integrity Project, they reported a lot more earnings after joining on, because people traveling through the I-5 corridor, going through Grants Pass, looking on Yelp, what, there's a GMO-free restaurant here? Infused, The Vine, Mimosas. They're always packed, they're doing well, they're expanding. And Jackson County, too, has Food Integrity Project now.
Yes.
So. And Karen Austin, who is one of the instrumental members of GMO-free Josephine County, she's been working with communities nationwide on developing food integrity programs and asking restaurants to be more transparent and offer GMO-free menu items. This is Melissa Wisterath, with the Center for Sustainability Law, an attorney here in Eugene. I'm Stephanie Dolan. I've been an attorney 19 years and executive director of the Northern California Tribal Court Coalition, and we're doing this work in tribal communities, by the way. This is Mary Middleton, our fantastic campaign manager for Oregonians for Safe Farms and Families. I'll talk just a little bit about our ordinance itself, if you want to hear it. Do people interested, or do you want to mostly talk? Yes, okay. In the summer of 2013, we had already been doing a lot of these events and educational activities around the GMO-free issue. We'd been talking about writing a local ordinance like Jackson County had done. And then we sort of started drafting and talking and talking and meeting and drafting. And then we started hearing rumblings about a state preemption effort, SB 863. Basically, Governor Kitzhaber decided to call an emergency session about the state retirement budget issues and throw in this GMO preemption issue that localities could not, what?
Bargaining chip.
Yeah, that was, he didn't
say. You might also notice the Monsanto Protection Act of Oregon, but just throw it in like
right. Yeah. So we started hearing about this, and we were like, it's time. So we did this Hail Mary pass. We drafted our ordinance. We modeled it after the California counties that are GMO-free, Marin, Mendocino, mostly Marin, but addressing some of their concerns, but also addressing Oregon's right to farm. It's a it's a simple law. It's 4.5 pages. You can find the text of it on Oregonians for Safe Farms and Families.org. And it's different from Jackson County's. It's just a little more single issue. We don't go in too much about abatement and that procedural stuff. The law maintains and protects seed sovereignty and local control, prohibits propagation, raising, growing of genetically engineered crops in Josephine County, and prohibiting the drift, allowing it to drift into Josephine County. And it provides a mechanism for Josephine County to enforce that. And it allowed for a 12-month phase-out period of those crops. So that's a little bit of the difference. And our ordinance is different than the community rights ordinances. It's narrower, less ambitious, less political. We wanted to get that done and get it passed to the best of our ability. But our hats are off, and we fully support the community rights effort. We were able to get our ballot title approved before SB 863 was signed into law, for what that's worth. Right now, we're still in the phase-out period. The law's on the books in Josephine County. The commissioners informed us they're not in a position to be proactive at this time with their enforcement efforts. So any violations of the law are going to be known September 2015. So, yes, sir.
How come Jackson County did much better on the GMO labeling compared to Josephine County, the lottery down there? How come you didn't do so good in Josephine County, and the election lost by just a little over 800 votes out of 1.5 million votes? And that was such a big issue with GMO.
That is a really good question. Probably poor Mary can talk about that.
Well, you know, it was a state-run campaign, and
they didn't follow our advice, which literally...
I wouldn't go that
far. No, yeah. Why?
Yeah, yeah.
We okay. suggest... I don't know. I didn't want to say we told you so, so I won't. But we said, we advised or strongly opined that we need to reach the rural counties. You can't depend on Multnomah and Portland. Talk to the conservatives. Talk to the Republicans. Talk to the churches. Why is this important? So I don't know that much about the campaign, but that's my feeling.
And I would add that. You know, that was something that we saw a lot. Like Chris from the early days was outreaching to the local Tea Party, Republicans. They were... We had Republicans that had done campaign statements in the voters' pamphlet. They were part of the campaign. The campaign looked different as a result. I think you saw much less focus from the labeling campaign on trying to recruit non-traditional. It was like, we know Democrats support labeling more and are more concerned about GMOs, and yet, you know, there wasn't, like, I know in Jackson County and just being there, big outreach to the churches, you know, to born-again Christians. Again, the advertisements all featured people who are Republicans saying, I'm for this measure. You have to make it acceptable for Republicans to be able to vote for this, and independents and libertarians, because there's a lot of common ground there.
We reached out to the Native Plant Society, Audubon Society, Rotary Clubs, Chamber, or who else? The Rogue Valley Realties Association, which is really pretty active, and stuff like that. So,
Americans for Prosperity.
I spoke at a meeting of the Republican Party and at the Southern Oregon Resources Alliance, which is folks from the extractive industries in Southern Oregon. You know, he didn't get his warmest reception at that meeting, but he was there. And I spoke at a 9/11 meeting in the Illinois, 9/12 meeting, sorry.
One of my favorite stories along that line is Elise Higley, one of the farmers and director of OFFC, went into Lars Larson, actually came to Jackson County to do a live broadcast show in a room that was filled with local Farm Bureau people. And she walked right into the Farm Bureau, sitting amongst a bunch of people who'd come in from out of county. And Lars, during the audio that I heard, says something, well, I assume there's no one here on behalf of the measure. And Elise chimes up, yes. And, you know, this nice woman walks up and he's, you know, says something, well, wow, you're brave. So it was like there was no walls. There were no limits on who you're going to talk to. And I thought that was really...
And also the sheer the opposition for the labeling effort, you couldn't go on... Hulu online or YouTube or Pandora, not just TV and print and direct mail. But you're flooded everywhere you look, especially I have people, a lot of people living in Portland who are foodies, only buy organic food, you know, left political leaning, telling me, no, I'm going to vote no. It's too confusing. Just parroting what they heard because it was so pervasive. It was frustrating.
I just wanted to quick get, Leah is an attorney with Earthrise, and I think an important part of this mix is thinking about the law before you would ever start a measure like this. And I know Dana, who's helping push a similar GMO ban in Benton County, is certainly aware of that, and others. It's good advice, but.
I mean, I don't have too much to add on top of what everyone has said, but I do think it's important that when you're thinking about drafting ordinances, like what they did in Josephine and like what they did in Jackson County and in other, you know, Hawaii and California and all these other places where they've done it, to take a look at the local laws, your state laws, your, you know, in the case now challenging the Jackson County, it's ordinance, it's the Oregon's Right to Farm Act. Obviously, that's something that we're all very concerned about. When you're drafting ordinances like this, lots of states have laws like that. So you should talk to, you know, local lawyers and take a look at those state laws, and constitutional challenges as well may also be a hurdle. So I think it's important to think about those from the very beginning, because, you know, the chemical companies, Monsanto and Syngenta, have a lot of money, and you can probably be assured that there might be some legal action down the road if you are successful in your actions to pass laws like this. So
I'm really glad you mentioned how you need to go beyond just Democrats, not being a former Democrat myself, now none of the above. 30 years ago, when we successfully stopped the food irradiation campaign, if anybody remembers food irradiation, one of the things we found in our strategy, trying to get the health food people involved, is that health food was not just a liberal cause, that it was as much conservative and people concerned about their precious bodily fluids and all that kind of thing, if you get the joke. And here in the Willamette Valley, a couple years ago, when the field burning was stopped, or mostly stopped, it was only stopped after the Republicans got sick of it too. Now, I'm certainly have no interest in being a Republican or a Democrat, but if the environmental crisis is really as severe as we say it is, then it's going to have to appeal to everybody who breathes and eats.
Has to be nonpartisan. That's probably one of the biggest takeaways. So sort of on that note, I think another really interesting bridge that can be drawn between partisan ideologies is self-reliance and national security. I was really surprised to see when I was volunteering for an urban farm in Colorado that there was a lot of interest in the sort of self-reliance table at this national security convention that was, they had like bulletproof window panes. And then they also had these like aquaponics farms, and it was interesting to see that crossover. But my question was related to the difference between the sort of countywide banning initiatives that were so successful in Oregon and then some of the other attempts to label GMOs. In Colorado, there was a sad death of a labeling bill, and I think one of the major detriments to that campaign was that a really, really strong community activist in Denver came out against labeling because he said that it wasn't tailored and that it was going to be a major cost to small farmers and that it wasn't going to work for a lot of the rural and small farming community. And I was wondering, is it true that countywide bans are actually more economically feasible for small farmers than labeling? And if not, what are ways that those types of campaigns can more effectively bring in sort of economically marginalized farmers?
Yes.
Good question.
So it's to be clear, they are two different things. It's really important to know that you're protecting the markets for these farmers. If the farmers cannot make the decision themselves what they are growing because the seeds they save themselves for their own production are likely ultimately going to be contaminated, as we know that's just the process. You cannot stop Mother Nature from doing what she does. So this is the most fundamental, if you believe in local food, this is the most fundamental channel that Josephine and Jackson County, and give thanks to Benton and Lane County moving forward with their efforts, Humboldt and others that are taking these actions. this is where the buck stops. If you have this technology produced across your county and blowing pollen everywhere, which you cannot control, you know, the USDA's best guess on sugar beets was 4 miles. If you talk to Dr. John Navazio, who's been breeding seeds for 3 decades or more, working for Washington State University and OSU, and working with Seed Alliance and others, he understands the safe distance is 10 miles, minimum 10 miles. So what this implies is if you're anywhere within the USDA's 4 miles is, well, you better just be safe because the seed company or the chemical company is just 5 miles down the road or some other producer of genetically engineered crops. So it implicates that we're going to have to test the entire food supply. If you're a seed grower, you take your seeds on and you sell to 10 different other farmers, and that's your local food system. Everyone's growing from just a few people who are producing seeds next door or near or within 4 or 5 or something miles of where this stuff is being produced. And that just adds more cost. That just needs to be figured into the whole how farmers are able to make a living wage. Otherwise, you know, farmer to have to test every little batch of seed, you know, it's $200, $250 here, there.
And you've been listening to a panel discussion on winning grassroots campaigns on a shoestring budget. Jackson and Josephine counties from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference held at the University of Oregon Law School in early March. Thanks to Paul Rowland for recording this program. And you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Health Watch. Today's guest is Gretchen Rubin, the author of New York Times bestsellers The Happiness Project and Happier at Home. And then at 11:30 on Madness Radio, Christopher Lane discusses his book, Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness. And I want to thank all you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor.